Welcome to the Real Sports Guys on realsportsguys.com. Today we're going to treat you to our greatest hits of the first couple of months of 2012. We'll start off with Jonah Carey, who came on to talk to RJ Page and our new Inside the Park baseball show. Then we'll move on to Wisconsin's football coach, Brett Bielema, who came to visit us in March. Dave Dorn, one of the rising stars in college football and currently at Northern Illinois, leading them to a MAC championship, will also be on. We'll revisit our highly listened to Mike Jarvis interview, who's the head coach at Florida Atlantic. And I really love this one because he talked about his time when he coached against the Fab Five when he was at George Washington. He also touched on some really big-time issues that were pretty hot at the time. T.J. Duckett, former NFL player, came on, and Todd talked about his time as an NFL player, but also the contributions that he's making to society now, and it's just outstanding to hear what this young man is doing. And then we'll move on to our college basketball interviews that we had. We had a ton during March Madness, as many of our listeners will remember. But the interview with VCU's associate head coach Mike Rhodes, Larry Hunter at Western Carolina, as well as Samika Rando at Ohio University are the ones that we handpicked today. When you hear this sound, that means we're moving on to the next interview. Hope you enjoy. Ray, Devon, Marcus, the Game Changer, myself, Phil T, will be back with you May 22nd. Hope you enjoy.
We got Jonah Carey coming on, acclaimed author. This guy is author of The Extra 2%, a book all about the Tampa Bay Devil Rays. I like to call it the new money ball. Jonah, are you there?
I am. You know that by calling them the Tampa Bay Devil Rays, you will be fined $1 by team president Matt Silverman. That's going to happen. He's going to call you up and take a dollar from you.
You know what, and I've read your book twice, and I know better. I'll be getting a letter in the mail and a fine. I would do that when you come on there. How you doing, brother?
I'm good. Everything is good. I'm over at Coors Field, actually. I'm covering the Rockies and the Giants and watching Tim Lincecum get lit up a little bit, surprisingly.
You know what, we were just talking about that. Is something going on with his velocity? What's going on with Tim Lincecum?
Oh, I wouldn't worry too much about it, and I know I heard you guys talking just before you brought me on about this whole idea of the first week and what he did with small sample size and so forth. His velocity is pretty okay. That is something that I would worry about, though, if a pitcher had problems like that. I mean, the guy that's bothering me a little is actually Josh Beckett, because his velocity was down from what it's been in the past, and his location was terrible, too. I mean, it just looked like he was supposed to have a thumb injury, and he sort of wondered, well, was he favoring his thumb, and that was causing him to throw straight and slow, which is a terrible combination. But you know, if you're talking about someone who would make you nervous, so I don't think Lincecum is the guy that Beckett might be.
Interesting. I think I was rooting all over the place in the offseason to watch out for Lincecum, the perceived down year from his standards. And it's funny to see that come to fruition. But I was at that game, the Beckett game in Detroit, and you're right, the ball was flying out of the park that day.
Oh, yeah. And it's a good listen. The Tigers are great. I mean, you talked about your Tigers and how good they are. There's no question about it. They have power hitters up and down the lineup. And there's no shame in giving up home runs to Prince Fielder and Miguel Cabrera. But, you know, maybe you do it once. I don't know if you do it five times. He absolutely got shelled in that game. And, yeah, you saw it live. You can attest. He didn't look like vintage Beckett, that's for sure.
Indeed. And I want to say I'm happy to have you on. I'm a big fan of your book. And
thank you.
Because we're going to talk to you about your book and some of your writing, I'm going to leave alone your projection for my Tigers this year. I won't go into that too tough, but I do want you to know I was reading, and I wasn't happy with your projection for my Tigers.
Wait a second. I wrote a column for people who don't know. I write for a site called Grantland.com, and the idea that I wrote about was over-unders for the baseball season. Vegas put that line and says, this team's going to win this, and this team's going to win that. My only objection was I didn't think the Tigers would win 94 games. I think they're going to probably run away with the AL Central. I'm just not sure they're a 100-win ball club. I suspect they have a lot of power. Maybe you have a couple holes with the defense, and Fister now being hurt and so forth. They're still going to win 90 games. They're still going to be a fine team. I just don't think they're going to be the most dominant team in the history of baseball.
Okay. I can give you that. Did you see the reports coming out of Detroit today that Victor Z-Mart may be coming back at the end of the season?
Perfect. So they're going to have six DHs in the lineup instead of five. That's tremendous. Good news.
Yeah, I think today's DH Andy Dirks may have a problem with that, but I was more than ecstatic. Indeed, indeed. But let's jump into your book. You wrote about the Tampa Bay Rays, and they're taking an interesting approach to winning, if I can say so myself. Why don't you tell the listeners a little bit about the Tampa Rays and what they've done to compete in that tough AL East?
Well, I mean, it's been a lot of things. You know, they're really focusing on under-the-radar methods for winning games. So one of the things that they've been emphasizing for years now is defense. And you know, we had the Moneyball era, and the idea was get on base and hit the PED and steroids era, where the idea was hit home runs. And they had these big, fat guys who couldn't really field, but they could hit 30 home runs and walk 100 times. And those are useful players, but the Rays sort of realized, hey, there's no more value in those players. We got to find something else. So they started looking for, you know, guys with diverse skills. They could run a little bit, they could catch the ball, they could play multiple positions, and that's really worked out for them. One of the maybe the poster child for that is Ben Zobrist, who isn't a burner necessarily, but he'll give you 20 steals. He plays great defense, not just the one position. He'll play the multiple positions, second base, and then the outfield. He's played some other spots too. They got him for nothing. They basically got him from Houston in kind of a throw into a trade. He was a good bench player. They decided to stick him in the lineup, and he became Zorilla. He became this power-hitting, all-around steals and defense and power, and just had everything going on. He was this great player. And they just have this uncanny knack for turning up gems like that. They develop good players, too. I mean, Evan Longoria and David Price and B.J. Upton, these are all number one draft choices. These are guys with a strong pedigree, and they've been very good, too. But the ability to sell out the rest of the roster is what really impresses me, because I think the one criticism that gets leveled against the Rays a little bit is, hey, if you start for 10 years, you can get all these number one picks, and it's really easy. Oh, well, gee, where are the Pittsburgh Pirates and the Baltimore Orioles and the Kansas City Royals? Do they have World Series pennants and I missed it? You know, they're not doing that well, despite the fact that they've sucked for a long time. But the Rays have found a way in that, yes, they draft well, but they just do such a good job of supplementing the roster, too. And I think the other big point is that once they get these guys and they're coming up, they sign them to these contracts. I mean, I don't know, man. These players, it looks like they're getting snookered a little bit. Longoria is signed to a 9-year, $48 million contract. I mean, I would love to make $48 million, but for a baseball player of Longoria's stature, that's an unbelievable deal for the Rays. Matt Moore, granted, you know, they give him job security and financial security 9 innings into his major league career, but they're basically paying him $14 million for 6 years with some club options. That could be another monster deal in favor of the Rays. They're willing to take a risk earlier in guys' careers, but so far all these deals have paid off. You look at Crawford, was signed to a long-term deal. That worked out before he ultimately left. Same thing with Shields. Same thing with Longoria and Zobrist and Matt Moore and all these guys. They find talent. They identify talent. They nurture talent. And then they find a way to sign them for much less than anybody else would. That basically is the expertise set.
I know you got to get out of here. You got a game to get back to. But if you could, real quick, tell the listeners about the new book that you're working on.
Sure.
I'm looking forward to it, and I'm going to pick it up when it comes out. But why don't you go ahead and share with the listeners about what you're working on?
Sure. Well, I was born in Montreal and raised and went to college there, and family and friends still live there. And I was a big Montreal Expos fan, me and 5 other people, basically. And so, I don't know, maybe it'll be read by 5 other people, you and my dad, so that'll be good. We'll get 7 sales. That'll be nice. But anyway, I'm writing a book about the Expos, the history of the team from 1969 till 2004, which is as long as they existed. And it's a little bit of everything. It's going to talk about kind of the history of the city and how the team came into existence and how all that happened, down to the players. You know, I've already interviewed guys like Kim Raines and Tim Wallach and you know, Cliff Floyd, some really good players from their history. I've got Randy Johnson on my list, and Larry Walker, and Marquis Grissom, and Moises Alou. And I think that it's fun to just hear from ex-major leaguers, really good ones, about what was it like playing in that city, and tell me about your baseball experiences and all that. But it'll be more than that. You know, it'll be the story of the city, the story of the players, the story of why it didn't work in Montreal, and maybe a little bit of personal stuff, too. I don't usually write I, and I'm not a big ego guy in my writing or in my work. But my publisher, my editor, has tried to impress on me, hey, listen, you're writing about the Expos, it's a personal experience, go ahead and do that. So it'll be a little bit of everything. If you're into just a straight sports book, that'll be there. If you're into business and politics, that'll be there. And if you're into kind of a little bit of a, you know, half memoir, I guess that's probably going to be in there, too. So we feel like it'll be a cool project, and it's going to come out not for 2 years. It's still got a ways to go. It comes out in the spring of 2014.
Okay, well, we'll be looking forward to it. Do you see baseball returning to Montreal?
oh, I don't think it's going to happen. I think that ship has sailed, and I've come to terms with it. It's a lovely city. I love going back, but, you know, I live here in Denver, and I'm happy to hop over to Coors Field and watch games here.
All right, John. Well, hey, we appreciate you taking the time out of your schedule. You stepped away from that what looks to be a blowout to talk to us. So we thank you for that. Listeners, if you want to check out Jonah's work, you can find him at www.jonahcarey.com, and that's spelled JonahKerry.com. And he also writes great baseball pieces over at Grantland.com. So do check him out. Jonah, we thank you from the bottom of our heart. We really appreciate you coming on, and we'll be looking forward to that new book.
Thanks for inviting me. It was a pleasure.
I mean, when you think about our guest today, in his first six seasons, he had 60 wins, six bowl appearances, five times his team has been a final AP top 25. He has two Big Ten titles, two trips to the Rose Bowl. His career winning percentage is .759, is fourth best in the country amongst FBS coaches with at least five seasons of experience. In his first 18 games, he won 17 of 18 games, which is second best start by head coach in Big Ten history. His team won the inaugural Big Ten football championship, defeating Michigan State Spartans 42-39 in a thriller in Indianapolis. So, hey, let's give a warm RSC welcome to head coach of the Wisconsin Badgers, Brett Bielema. How you doing, Brett?
I'm doing all right. Officially been married for 4 days, so it's kind of been a whirlwind, but it's good.
Woo! Well, the thing about it is you joined the RSG, a few guys here who understand the value of marriage, and so we want to welcome you to the fold.
I appreciate it.
You know, Coach, before we get into, you know, I know you're going to be kicking off the spring game on the 28th, in, I believe, in April. Before we get in that, you know, you were 11-3 last year. You finished 10th in the final AP poll. As I said in the opening, you won the inaugural Big Ten championship game, but you were really two plays away from making a bid for a national championship game. You know, as you think about and kind of summarize the 2011 season for the Badgers, how have you been reflecting on that season?
Well, you know, really after the season is done, after that final bowl game and the game that you play in, obviously the last 2 years for us, the Rose Bowl, you really have a time there during January where you do a lot of recruiting, a lot of traveling. I believe I had 27 flights from January 3rd until the signing date, the 1st of February, and has a lot of time on the airplane to think about things. You know, I don't know if I've ever been in a season where there were the highest of the highs and the lowest of the lows as much as there was last year. I mean, obviously, I think back, you know, the first Big Ten game to welcome Nebraska into the Big Ten and for us to play the way we did and really handle them pretty well, and you know, a night game in Camp Randall, we all know how special that is. Then take a bye week and come back and lose, you know, to Michigan State the way we did at the end of the game was gut wrenching. To come back and play your tail off in Columbus, another night game, and to lose at the last minute like we did there was really a testing point, I think, for the chemistry of our entire program. You know, how the players are going to respond, how the coach is going to respond, and obviously responded very, very well. Put ourselves in a November that we needed to win every game, that put us in December to win another game against Michigan State to get an opportunity to go to the Rose Bowl, and it happened. And then obviously to lose a Rose Bowl, you know, as hard fought a game as it was to such a good team, it just took a couple weeks to get that out of your system, but our kids have been great coming back so far.
When I think about the season, you had two dynamic offensive players in Monty Ball and Russell Wilson. I mean, Monty Ball had, you know, 1,923 yards rushing, 33 touchdowns, Heisman finalist. Russell Wilson, 40 touchdowns, you know, 30 passing, 6 rushing, 1 receiving. You kind of, in this season, shattered this notion that Wisconsin football is 3 yards in a cloud of dust. Talk a little bit about those two players in this season and what that meant to have those two type of players on your squad.
Well, then I think first off, you know, the thing that both of them would tell you is they probably enjoyed the other one's success as much as anything. They really are really selfless kids that understand the value of chemistry and teamwork and working together. But I would say Monty Ball, you know, he's a guy that really going back to a year ago, January, I saw him restructure his body and you know, dedicate himself to the you know, nutritional side and the training side as hard as any player I've ever seen, and really reap the reward because of it. I mean, just the way he's sculpted his body and got himself ready to play, and then the guy that added obviously a lot to our team this year, Russell Wilson, is just a you know, I know everybody's going to think it's coach speak or it's coaching cliche. As good a football player is, he's an even better person, an even better human being. Just great chemistry. Brought it to the locker room right away. The kids, you know, elect him captain 4 weeks later. He's so dynamic as a leader and as a guy that can really, you know, his two best quarters of football might have been the fourth quarter against Ohio State and Michigan State. I mean, he played and got us into those games, and all they ended up being losses. That was really, in my mind, stands out as some of his best football. So both great kids. I think you're going to hear about Russell next year in the NFL a lot earlier than most people think. And then Imani, when he gets this time a year from now, I think it'll be the exact same.
When you think about it, a lot of folks thought that Imani should have moved on to the NFL, and he's decided to stay. What was his decision-making process? What happened? You know, how did you, I guess, talk to him, work with him through that decision-making process? But what was it about for him coming back to play again?
Well, make no mistake, he was the best recruiting job of the year. I mean, doubt about that. He was on campus, but we wanted to make him stay. And you know what? I think the thing that I believe really came through to the forefront was just complete, honest approach to everything we did. I brought his parents in during the bye week, brought him in actually last spring for the first time, and talked about you know, the things that we could do for him to help get the best information out there. And then during our bye week, we sat down again and just kind of talked about, hey, this is where we're at. We'll fill out the NFL paperwork to get an early draft status. And then he really kind of set in his mind, and I told him, you got to come up with a number. You know, what number will come back if you want to go, and what number comes back will you want to stay? And if it was a first rounder, I think he was gone for sure. You know, if it was a second round grade, he probably still would have been gone. And he came back as a strong third round grade, and he had kind of made a decision with his parents to stay if that was the case, and get his degree and finish his work here at Wisconsin before moving on. So I think just the whole approach was pretty smart by his process.
One of the things that I think that, and as we start to talk about the entering class of players, I was listening to a lot of conversation when they were talking about signing day and who had the top class, and they were interviewing the expert, and I remember someone saying, you know, we're not going to know what these players are going to do until about 3 or 4 years. We'll know what this class is all about. But we can't get so caught up in the rankings. And he used Wisconsin as an example of a program that has produced a number of players who've gone on to go in the NFL. I mean, Wisconsin players are all over the NFL, and really talked about, you know, the development of players. And that made me think a little bit about, you know, how do you approach, because I thought that was a compliment to a lot of the work that you and your staff are doing. How do you approach the recruiting class? And before we get into the players that you have coming in, you know, what are the kinds of things you look for when you're recruiting players?
Well, I think there's three critical things we try to evaluate. You know, obviously they got to be a good enough football player. There's somebody that we care about and think that they can help us win a championship. That should be pretty easy to see on film. You know, and I really don't care who's recruiting them. I don't care if they have 20 offers. I don't care if they have 2 offers or 0 offers. What we do is make our own evaluation off film, and we kind of have always looked for that underrated guy, maybe that guy that is just going to fit our type. And then the other two areas, obviously, besides the football skills, is, you know, academically, how do they check out? You know, to be here in Wisconsin, you have to be a certain type of student, not just to get admitted, but also to stay in school. You know, it doesn't do you any good for a kid to be here in year 3. He's no longer around because he couldn't handle the academics. They're going to be their best players in years 3, 4, and 5, and you want them to be here. And then, you know, the third thing is just the social element. I really believe in a couple things. I always tell my coaches, hey, if you're recruiting this kid and you're wondering or not whether he's really kind of our type of kid, whether he can fit into Madison, just ask yourself, would you let him babysit your children in your own home for 2 nights when you weren't there? You know, it's a simple question, but it's easy for people to answer, you know, and I think that one part, we're never going to trade in an ounce of character to try and get a better football player. I think it's important for you to, you know, bring kids that you like to be around. So I'll go back to last year. I thought this was a great stat. You know, this last season was my sixth year as a head coach, so it's you know, my class, everybody in that room were guys that we've decided we wanted in there. I didn't inherit any of them. I brought them in, made the decisions. Well, the class before that was my first championship season, and it was my fifth year. So it was kids that, again, was my first five whole years of being with them. Mm-hmm. And when the NFL signed, you know, first day of NFL camp, there were 14 rookies on NFL rosters that were from the University of Wisconsin.
Wow.
And to put that in perspective, the next highest class was Alabama. The next highest team was Alabama, had 8. So we had almost double the second highest total. And at first it alarmed me because I'm like, boy, that's a lot of players that aren't here. But it did show me, you know, hey, we went on to win another championship without them. But also that class, when they were as freshmen, they were rated 8th in the Big Ten. I believe they were like 60th in the country. And they had 14 guys in the NFL. It just made a huge statement to me. And this year, I think we'll do the same. This year, I would bet we have a minimum of 12 players that sign NFL contracts, might have as many as 16 of our seniors. So it's really a good time to take a step back and realize, hey, don't really buy into what's going on around you. Just go and, you know, believe in what's in front of you. And our kids really do buy into that.
And you had a record 6 players playing the Senior Bowl, right?
Yeah, that was the highest ever. It was also... we had 23 All Big Ten academic All Big Ten players, which was the highest in school history. You know, I do believe there's a correlation to that stuff. And one of the best phone calls I got in January, second week of January, I was on a recruiting trip and I got a voicemail from our academic support staff, and we actually set a fall semester entire roster. My entire 120 man roster had a set of school. Semester GPA record in the fall semester, which,
okay.
You know, I mean, that stuff, it all goes together, you know. I really believe that, you know, you just, and some of these kids, you know, don't come in, you know, I'm not saying every one of the kids is top 10% in the class, but if you get a kid, you know, that has got, you know, a decent academic background and he shows great signs of being able to work for what he wants, you know, and then he gets into our support system, those kids just flourish. Because they see themselves having success, and that really makes a big difference. It gives them great confidence.
Now, you have 12 scholarship players coming in, and one of them, obviously, J.J. Watt's younger brother, amongst that crew. But talk a little bit about, and plus, and people don't know as well as you place a lot of value also in your preferred walk-on. So some of these folks who are coming in as well, but talk about some highlights in this entering class of new backers.
Well, we are excited. Derek was actually in last year's freshman class, so he's been on campus for a year. Look great about him. But in this latest class, we added an in-state prospect that we're very excited about, Vince Deagle, a kid from up in Wisconsin Rapids. His dad, Rocky Deagle, was an All-American at BYU and was a highly, highly recruited kid. And had him in camp the last couple summers. I think he'll be a perfect fit. We'll play him at linebacker and get excited to get him on campus. We signed 3 freshmen that are actually left school early January as seniors and are currently enrolled in second spring semester. Well, the first one, Dan Volz, lineman out of Chicago, who has been very impressive, weighs about 300 pounds and has developed really, really nicely for a high school kid coming in. Fits in right away. And we also have a kid by the name of Avante Jackson, who's from Kenosha Bradford, a running back who unfortunately blew out his knee ACL the first game of his senior year, but has really done a nice job in rehab, and it should be able to go with us in the fall and see where he's at. And then we also had a young man, Hugs Atenay, from down in Boyd Anderson, or I'm sorry, Plantation, Florida, and has really been impressive through fall, or through these first couple of weeks of winter drills. He's a corner who's very athletic, very gifted, and excited. So I would joke, it's kind of nice. We got 2 kids out of Florida. One was Hugs at the Nay, and then we got a Reggie Love. Anytime you got a Love and a Hugs coming out of Florida, we're good. Reggie Love is a wide receiver that we're very excited about as well.
Now, you've made some inroads into Florida. Can you talk a little bit about how you've been able to kind of work state of Florida, you know, and get folks to come up in Wisconsin? And I worked in admissions and recruiting, and sometimes getting, you know, kids from warm weather states looking at the state of Wisconsin is sometimes a challenge. So how do you really try to work some of those and get some players out of Florida?
Well, the first thing is you have them visit in June and July. That's a very important element. You know, we don't bring them in December and January too often. But I think, again, it's like what kind of kid are you looking for? For instance, you know, you take James White, who's, you know, a great player for us, comes from a private school, St. Thomas Aquinas, who I brought in two of his roommates, Connor O'Neill, as well as Desmond Southward. Des is in the business school as a junior, and Connor is as well. And as you know, in working here in Wisconsin, that's not an easy thing to do. So, you know, two kids are already in there. But again, it's, you know, all of them come from, you know, two-parent homes. All of them come from, we do recruit a lot of the private schools, or we look for a certain type of kid that'll fit into our environment. I think that's very important. And I think the part that, you know, South Florida isn't really any different from recruiting a kid out of Jersey or recruiting a kid out of Ohio. You know, they're going to leave their home state, but, you know, you got to be smart about where you're going. For instance, in Florida alone, I learned this one being an assistant coach. I started recruiting to South Florida, you know, like Fort Lauderdale, Miami, and Palm Beach. So I said, well, this is going good. Why don't I expand a little further? So I went into Orlando for a couple of years, and I'd get in these recruiting battles, and you just couldn't beat, you know, the Carolina schools, the Georgia schools, mm-hmm. as consistently as you could with a South Florida kid. Because a South Florida kid, I mean, he's down there now. He's going to have to travel 12, 14 hours to go to school in Georgia. Well, the Orlando kid's only got to travel 6 or 7, and it does make a difference. There's almost like this little line across the state that kids will leave and go anywhere in the country, especially in the Big Ten where they can get great exposure.
Okay. Coach, one of the things I wanted to hit before we let you go, one of the hardest things, I mean, you've done an incredible job, and we talked about what you accomplished in the first 6 years, but I think the most difficult thing you've done is to follow a legend like Barry Alvarez and to begin to develop your own brand and your own kind of legacy within the program. Talk a little bit about how that process has happened and how Coach Alvarez has also played a role in you establishing, you know, this as your program.
Absolutely. I think, you know, from my initial conversation with Coach Alvarez when we talked about this transition, he was very adamant about, you know, putting my own stamp or my own brand in the program. We talked about how there's definitely some things that work here at Wisconsin that should be kind of standard and move forward, and those were easy things for me to witness 2 years as an assistant, you know, just the brand of football, the way we have to prepare and train, what our advantages can be. You know, we may not be the most physically talented, but we definitely can be the most physically tough and mentally tough. I think that's a part that's carried through. And then as far as the transition, I believe my staff and my staff has been, you know, on a revolving process as well, you know, just with new faces, new people. But we stuck true to what Wisconsin really had been defined as, you know, hardworking, tough, don't beat yourselves, play smart, play physical, and you know, recruit a certain type of kid, a certain type of character that is never going to waver. So I know there's people from the outside world that think Wisconsin is, you know, the same thing it's always been, but it really is completely evolved into something I think competes on a national basis, you know, in a world of college football that really has changed, you know, over the last, you know, 5 to 10 years. So it's been a lot of fun. You know, one of our biggest fans and one of our biggest supporters is Coach Alvarez. I mean, obviously as an AD to have a guy in that role that sat in your shoes and knows how difficult it can be is a truly huge advantage, and something that I'm blessed with as a head coach here on a daily basis.
Well, Coach, we do want to wish you well as you get into spring practice and into the spring season. And we'd love to invite you back as you get closer to the opening of the season. We certainly enjoyed having you on with us at The Real Sports Guys, and thank you for joining us.
Absolutely. Appreciate the offer. Thank you very much. I'm Wisconsin.
All right. University of Wisconsin Badger head coach Brett Bielema. You know, that's what I'm talking about. This is someone who's been making noise nationally as it relates to college football. It's a program that has really established itself, you know, as a national power, and he's put together a really good team there. When you start to think about the lineage of coaches, Paul Chris, who's his former offensive coordinator, I believe, is at Pittsburgh. His former defensive coordinator, head coach at Northern Illinois University. And so this is only in 6 seasons that these folks are going on and getting head coaching positions. So excited about having him on. We're going to have a little bit of reaction and going back and forth. Game changer You had a chance to hear Coach Bielema talk. You know, you and I are very familiar with Wisconsin and the program. You know, I'd love to get your thoughts.
You know, it was really great to hear them talk about the recruiting philosophy of the program. Because, you know, as fans of the program, we all look at what the profile of every recruiting class that comes into Wisconsin. When you're looking at that, they're always like 60, 55, 50. They never have those glitz and glamour recruiting classes. But in the end, the coaching staff, Bielema and his guys, always get guys who, they always coach them up. They always get them to the league. They always get them to compete, which is an amazing thing because they never come in with that gravitas, with the big name. They don't come in like that. You know, they get kids who are good football players who they can develop, who fit into their system, and then they get them and they coach them up. And I think that's it was just really interesting for me to be able to hear him talk about what they look for when he talks about integrity and those kind of things, and what the profile of a Wisconsin recruit is. Because again, they're not the perennial 4-star, 5-star national big name guys. They're not going to be guys you see playing in the Under Armour games or, you know, any other end of the season national all-star games who, you know, they're not signing day cats who you see on ESPN with the hats trying to pick a hat. These are guys that usually fly under the radar. They're good football players. They're quality football players. And Wisconsin figures out a way to get them in and make them better. And that was real interesting to see because, again, it's something that as a fan base we sometimes are concerned about because we see that and we're saying, well, we're not getting guys. We're not competing with the Alabamas and the TCUs and the Texases and the USCs. We're not getting those kind of guys. And so, you know, we worry when we go up against those teams, but our guys usually hold their own. So, you know, hats off to Coach Bielema. And like I said, it was really interesting to hear him talk about that.
Well, you know, we're going to try and carry that thread going through. We're going to try and get some more coaches on to talk about that because, Game Changer, I think you hit right the point. I mean, getting into the psychology of a program in terms of how they approach players, I think it's very critical. It helps coach the fans and folks to understand that there's many different ways to build a national champion and or a competitive team that can be there every year. And to understand that, I think, is very important. Your analysis was right on point. I know we got the PhD back in the game. Phil, you had a chance to do it. I know you've been working a lot with setting this up with Coach Bielema. I'd love to get your reaction before we send it back to the game changer.
That was an excellent interview. And like Marcus, it was really helpful to hear some of the philosophies of the program, which helps explain, A, why they've been so successful, and B, you know, why they have produced so many players that fit in NFL type of systems. And one of the things he mentioned was that they're right up there, if not the top, in terms of producing NFL players, that are successful in the league and make it into the league. And I think it comes back to a focus on character and finding guys who fit certain niches, who do certain things good. So it was really impressive to hear that. First-class guy, Coach Bielema. I've had a chance to interact with him throughout this process. So, again, it was just outstanding to hear thoughts in terms of the program, Russell Wilson, and the direction they're taking to move forward.
You're on with the Real Sports Guys, College Football Spring Edition. We're on with the Northern Illinois University head coach, Dave Doran. Northern Illinois won the MAC championship in 2011 and went on to win the GoDaddy Bowl, winning over Arkansas State. This is an incredible start for Coach Doran, had the best winning start of any Husky coach in history. Welcome to the Real Sports Guys, Coach.
Doing great, Devon. Thanks for having me.
Coach, you had, if I were to describe it, an incredible first year as a head coach. You finished 11-3. You win the MAC championship. Then you win the GoDaddy Bowl over Arkansas State. But you started out 2-3. And it was, in terms of just kind of establishing yourself, that might have been a tough period. Can you talk a little bit about your start and then what happened at the beginning of the season and what happened in terms of making that turnaround?
Well, it was a team that won 11 games the year before with a previous coaching staff. And I think, you know, when you have success, the hardest thing is to maintain that level of success. And I think our players early in the season probably thought they were a little better than they were and had to get scarred. You know, we had to get scarred a little bit and get beaten down, kind of get a reality check that we've got to play perfect to win and we've got to prepare the right way and have a chip on our shoulder just like they did the year before. And we had to go through that period, I think, to realize what it takes to be a championship team. And as a coaching staff, as a support staff, and as a team, I think it was a great eye-opener, and it really brought our players and coaches together because of the scrutiny that's involved with that kind of start to your season.
You're listening to Real Sports Guys on realsportsguys.com. We're talking to Coach Dorn, the head coach of the Northern Illinois Huskies. Coach, you just had your spring game this past weekend. Talk a little bit about how your spring practices went.
Well, they went really well. You know, we were blessed with weather, and we just broke ground Saturday at our spring game for our indoor football facility, the Chesick Performance Center that's going to open in August of 2013. So that was a big step, but we don't have it yet. So we practice outside, and if the weather's good, we have a really good day, and if it's cold, it's a good day to run the ball, you know. And so we were lucky this spring because we had a lot of great days, and I think our kicking game really improved because we were able to be outside every day and not have high winds and cold weather. But it was good. You know, our guys know the system now. They've been with these coaches for their second year, and so they're not learning a system. They're just getting better at fundamentals and trying to improve their weaknesses.
Coach, you got 19 starters coming back, including a couple of key guys who missed the 2011 season due to injury. You opened
the season
with a very high-profile matchup against Iowa at Soldier Field in Chicago. Talk about that matchup and what that's going to mean to your program.
Well, you know, Kirk Ferentz is a guy that I look up to in this profession. I think he's, you know, one of the guys that every year he's got his team ready to play. I mean, Iowa's always competitive. They always are physical. They're always very fundamentally sound. And they're tough, you know. And so whenever you play the Hawkeyes, you've got to be ready for that kind of game. And so it's a great game for us to open up with because it's about fundamentals. It's not about flash and, you know, how you look. It's about what you do and how hard you do it and how long you do it and not beating yourself. And so I'm really excited to play them. And every year when we played Iowa when I was at Wisconsin, it was a slugfest. And so I have a real good idea what we're in for. And, you know, last year we opened up with Army and we spent all camp working on triple option. And that hurts your team a little bit, you know, because you don't see it all season. And Iowa's more of a basic team where a lot of the things that we're going to be talking about are going to carry through the year. And I think that'll help us.
Well, Coach, definitely want to thank you for being on with us. Hopefully we can have you back for that Iowa game to check in with you. And we want to wish you well with your preparation for next year. And thank you for being on the Real Sports Guys.
Thanks for having me, guys. Go Huskies.
As Phil alluded to, I think all three of us are excited about our first guest tonight. He took the Owls of Florida Atlantic to the NIT in a 21-game winning season in 2010-2011. He is one of eight coaches who won 100 or more games with three different teams. If he accomplishes that same feat, which we expect him to do, with Florida Atlantic, he'll be one of two coaches, which include Lefty Giselle, who's done it with four schools. Please welcome head coach of the Florida Atlantic Owls, Mike Jarvis. Coach Jarvis, welcome to the show.
Hey, it's great to be on. I'm looking forward to it. Thank you.
Coach Jarvis, you so know all of us have a lot of respect for you, so we're definitely excited to hear about what you're doing at Florida Atlantic, but also just to hear your perspective and talk a little bit about your journey as a coach. As I mentioned in my opening, you are one of eight coaches who won 100 or more games in three different institutions. Can you talk a little bit about how your coaching philosophy has developed over the years through the different institutions where you've worked?
Well, you know, I'm really blessed. I mean, I've been coaching at a time when there were very, very few black coaches in the profession. You know, started out teaching in high school and then was fortunate enough to get to be an assistant coach in college while I was teaching, and then got a chance to coach at my alma mater at Cambridge Virginia Latin and work with a couple of guys that the good Lord sent me by the name of Patrick Ewing and Ramil Robinson and that led to Boston University, and that led to George Washington, and that led to St. John's, and then ESPN, and now I'm at Florida Atlantic trying to build a program that's really, you know, never been before, with my son, who's my associate head coach, and my really competent assistant. So it's been an incredible journey and a lot of fun, and at all different levels, and I've enjoyed every minute of it.
You coached Patrick Ewing in high school. For some of our listeners under 30 who may not understand how great Patrick Ewing was as a player, can you talk about Patrick Ewing, his development, and just the experience of coaching a phenom like that?
Well, you know, once again, it was a different time. I don't know if I would have ever been able to do what I did with Patrick and for Patrick in this day and age with all the, you know, the people that get a hold of these kids at a very young age. But, you know, I had the total blessing of his mother, Dorothy, to help to develop him, and not only to a basketball player, but also as a student and as a person. And, you know, I first started working with Patrick before I ever coached him formally when he was in junior high school. I, you know, used to teach he and his phys ed teacher the game of basketball. And then, later, you know, a few years later, I got a chance to coach him in high school. One of the most competitive people that I've ever had the opportunity to work with. And, you know, during our time together in high school, we won 3 consecutive state championships. We're number one in the country. Lost one game. And, in fact, people say, how'd you lose that game? And I say, real simple. Patrick was sick that night. We lost to the state champs of Connecticut. And but nobody practiced harder, worked harder, and he just developed. He went from being a skinny, gangly kid that everybody used to laugh at to a guy that ended up making $18 million his last year of playing basketball. And, you know, just a winner. I mean, a winner, a warrior. And, you know, his career at Georgetown and with the Olympics and with the Knicks, I mean, you know, you just don't get too many players. In fact, there's probably no more than 10 players in the history of the game that were any better than Patrick.
You talked about, when talking about Patrick, you talked about how much different it was back then. And I know you've been somewhat, you might, and what I'm sensing, if I may be wrong, somewhat outspoken about the impact that folks have had on particularly AAU and other folks in terms of the ability to really engage these athletes. How has that impacted you in terms of your current recruitment strategy with Florida Atlantic?
Well, you know, I wish I could say it hasn't impacted me at all. I wish I could honestly say that, you know, nothing has really changed. But the reality is that so much has changed. And what it's made me do, me personally, is really even become even more committed to getting the right kids to come to our school. And, you know, you make mistakes, but I think I find myself now really, really trying to find the right character guys so that everybody can have fun. Because, you know, what I found today is that most of the kids that play today, majority of them are not about winning. They're about stats. They're about playing, you know, to get to the next level. And only a very, very, you know, minuscule number of kids are ever going to do that. So I'm trying to recruit guys now, like I used to do in the old days, and, you know, maybe get some guys like I had back at Boston U or GW or St. John's that, you know, were about the team first and didn't really care about their stats, you know, unless their team won. And that's the challenge because, like I said, the kids today, very, very different. You know, it's mostly about them, and that's why you see hundreds and hundreds of kids transferring every year.
Coach, you heard in our opening and in talking a little about this, sometimes, you know, it's as you're trying to find about fit, and, you know, obviously there was a lot of discussion last week with what happened at Wisconsin in terms of blocking transfers and, you know, freedom of players to go different places. Can you talk a little bit about the whole idea of the discussion about the movement of players and the idea of trying to build a program and the right fit? I think all those issues came up last week. What was your perspective on this kind of a national conversation about athletes and their ability to go from one place to the other?
Well, first of all, you know, I mean, you know, there's three sides to every story, and you know, and on one hand, you know, I know people are saying, well, you know, kids should be able to move and go where they want to go, and there's some truth to that, but at the same time, you know, when guys, you know, go to a program, you know, they should be going there to get an education first. And then to develop their basketball game second. And in the process, realize that it's not going to happen yesterday. And the problem today is that so many of these kids, they'll tell you that they want it, like, immediately. And they you know, they don't want to many times pay the price and play the patient game because, you know, they're thinking they're going to be one and down or two and down and, you know, and I mean, there are kids transferring that are playing 38 and 39 minutes a game and leading their team and scoring. And you know, a lot of kids now that are going to schools with the idea that they'll have a good year and then they'll transfer up. And I mean, that is really, I think it's doing it's hurting the game a lot. Now, there are extenuating circumstances that may arise that a kid, you know, just may have made a bad decision, you know, or maybe somebody made the decision for him as he went to school, or maybe there's a home situation that would, you know, necessitate him coming back home. But the majority of the kids today, they're not transferring for those reasons. They're transferring because they want to get, you know, they want to get more minutes, they want to get more stats, they want to, you know, further their game. And I don't think a lot of them really think about the impact that it's having on their team. And that, to me, is the problem. And, you know, like last week, I'm sure, you know, last week you guys have been talking a lot about the Wisconsin situation. And, you know, what we hear sometimes as coaches might be a little different than what maybe the listening audience might hear. For example, you know, I was told that it's very possible that maybe the youngster never even contacted his coach. I mean, so you got kids sometimes leaving situations before they even talk to their coach, let alone their teammates.
You're listening to The Real Sports Guys, realsportsguys.com. We're on with Florida Atlantic coach Mike Jarvis. And, Coach, I really respect that perspective about the delayed gratification. And we've had a lot of debate around that on our show, and separating out the right versus the what's the educational benefit. So I really appreciate that. As that is the context for you shaping your program, and I like the idea, and I believe some coaches are going to have to just go back to the old school philosophy, looking for the diamond in the roughs, thinking about how they want to build their programs that way. Can you talk a little bit about, you know, your current team? You had a really good year in 2010, 2011,
mm-hmm.
You really built some steam. You had a little step back this past year, but you know, right now you got a player like Raymond Taylor who is foregoing his senior year. So you obviously have talented players who you've been able to upgrade and bring to the program. Can you talk a little bit about some of the players, and maybe let's just start with Raymond Taylor in terms of his decision to forego his senior year and what he's meant to your program?
Well, first of all, let me just say this. You know, we had a great year. Our third year in, you know,
yeah.
We go from winning six games to winning 20-plus games and winning the Sun Belt regular season tournament. I mean, we had a great year and beat some really, really good teams. And this year, we did not have, I mean, we had a bad year. And I say a bad year because we were in every game except for two, and yet we couldn't finish and, you know, and win the games in the end. And you know, we're no different than a lot of people. We've got you know, Ray Taylor, little Ray, 5'6" 6 inches of him, you know, feels that, you know, he can play at the next level, and you know, he leaves school, and only time will tell, you know, whether or not that was a bad decision or a very bad decision. So we're gonna, you know, unfortunately, he's gonna find out sooner than later that, you know, maybe it wasn't the right decision. I mean, I'm hoping that somehow, you know, he can perform the unthinkable and make it, you know, at this stage of his development. You know, but you can't, I mean, you know, you can't make people do things. And he felt that,
that, you know, he wanted to give it a shot and not wait another year to try. And it's going to be very difficult, you know, when you're looking at a guy who's only 5'6" tall. And, you know, plus he's coming off a team that only won 11 games last year. And, you know, so we deal with the same issues at our level that bigger schools do at their level. The difference is a lot of the kids at the bigger schools, you know, you take Kentucky, I mean, those kids are going there with the idea they're going to be one and done. You know, you'd like to hope that the kids that come to a school like ours, they're coming with the idea it's going to be four and graduate and then see what happens. But so, you know, we've got guys that will think they're ready and leave as well. And you just hope and pray that they're right. Unfortunately, the majority of the times the kids are wrong. And because only a few guys are going to make it to the NBA, you know, next year. I mean, what's the number? You probably know the number better than I of kids, of new players in the NBA. It's not very many.
No, it's not very many. And, you know, before I hand it over to my partner, Phil, to ask a question, and I love the way you're approaching this and the fact that you're also doing it with your son, because we want to dig into your team a little bit. But talk with us, men, about being in this experience and coaching with your son and doing that, what that's meant to you.
Well, it's meant everything to me. You know, I am so blessed. I mean, I've been married to the same woman. We're going to celebrate. My wife, Connie, and I will celebrate our 45th anniversary in September. My son, Mike, has been with me for 43 years. He was my bat boy as a three-year-old, you know, up to about age eight. And when I was coaching freshman baseball in high school, he was my ball boy at Cambridge and Gillette. And he played for me in high school, played for me in college. And when he graduated from Boston University, he was my assistant. In fact, the first year, imagine coming out in the Sweet 16 of the NCAA tournament as the Cinderella 12 seed to play the Michigan Fab Five in front of 41,000 people in Seattle. And we almost beat them. And he was my assistant back then. He's been with me every year except for a couple when, you know, we were out of coaching after St. John's. He went to work at Duke with Mike Krzyzewski. And when I went back into coaching, he called and said, "Dad, I want to get back into the business as well." And it's been a blessing. It's the greatest trophy that any coach could ever, ever, ever have. The greatest award or achievement is to have their son working with them side by side. And, you know, it makes life that much more meaningful every day knowing that I'm going to be with my son. And, you know, the hardest day in my life is probably going to be, and, you know, hopefully it's not too long when he's a head coach and he has to, you know, say goodbye to his dad. But it's been great. And, you know, we were the first African-American father-son coaching tandem in the history of the Division I basketball. A lot of people don't know that. But we were the first, and hopefully we won't be the last.
You're listening to the Real Sports Guys on RealSportsGuys.com. We have the privilege of speaking to Florida Atlantic's head coach, Mike Jarvis. Coach, talk a little bit about your incoming recruiting class and players that you think will contribute to your team right away, including your players that are coming back.
Yeah, well, first of all, we've got Greg Gant, who's going to be a senior next year coming back, and he's been an all-league player and, you know, been our leading scorer for the last couple of seasons. And, you know, Greg's a shooting guard, and, you know, so we're counting a lot on him. And our best recruit actually was a redshirt last year, 7-foot youngster from Croatia that actually originally was at Baylor. You talk about transfers, and, you know, he transferred. He's my only transfer, but he's 7-foot. He's got a lot of talent. Dragon is a heck of a player, and I think he's going to be one of the best big men in the Sun Belt Conference. And we're going to bring in a full class. I mean, really what we're doing this year is we're starting all over again. We're going to have six new guys coming in. I've got one of the most incredible athletic guards I've ever recruited, a kid by the name of Stephen Moody out of Poinciana, Florida. This guy plays, I mean, at 5'10", I mean, he's a guy that you will constantly be playing above the square. I mean, this guy is he just jumps out of the gym, and he can play. I've seen him, you know, get 40 and 50 without even trying, and you know, Chris Bryant, 6'8", youngster, was player of the year a couple years ago, went to prep school. You know, he was player of the year in Florida out of Tallahassee. Jackson Trapp, you know, 6'4", shooting guard. You know, got a young man coming in from Spain. That's another 6'9 guy. I got Devontae Thornton coming out of Atlanta, about 6'7", 6'8", wing. So we're going to have size, finally going to have a team with some size at different positions. We're going to be, I think, much more athletic than we've ever been. And, you know, you combine those new guys, you know, with Greg Gant and Jordan McCoy and Andre Madison and Pablo Patron and, you know, the guys that are coming back, I think we're going to be deep. I think we're going to really be able to play the kind of basketball that I want to play. And, you know, I think our very best is ahead of us. And, you know, I'm really looking forward to next season.
Now, Coach, you're currently at Florida Atlantic. I've always been interested to know how coaches, especially at mid-major schools, how they schedule their season in order to peak at the right time. Can you talk a little bit about your philosophy in setting up your schedule now that you're at Florida Atlantic?
Well, first of all, when you're at the mid or low Division I schools, there's certain things you have to do. One of the things you have to do is you got to raise money. So what you mean is you got to play 3-4 guarantee money games. You know, you got to play, like, for example, next year we're playing North Carolina. We're playing Mississippi State. We're playing Indiana. I mean, every one of those schools is going to pay us a decent amount of money to come and play them. Okay, so that helps you basically, run your program. But it also gives you national, big-time national exposure. So my hope and my prayer is that we'll be able to compete in those games, be in a position, you know, on a given night to maybe knock off one of those people. If you do, then you are already established yourself and you're on the map. And if you can compete with them, you know, then what it's going to do is going to set you up when you play in conference. So, you know, we've got a 20-game Sun Belt Conference schedule, plus the money games, plus we play home and homes with teams like Harvard University, who should win the Ivy League, and Hofstra out of the Colonial. We play George Mason. I mean, so we have a really good non-league schedule, but with some balance, and we try to play teams from different conferences so that if you have a good year, then they can look at your schedule and they can say, okay, you know, you compete against teams from the Big East or from the ACC or the SEC or the Atlantic 10, and you beat some of those people. So now you got a chance of not only getting a bid, you know, getting into the tournament by winning your league tournament, but, you know, hopefully you get to a point where you're good enough where you get in that large bid. That's what we did when we were at George Washington. So you got to play up. I mean, you really do. And at the same time, you got to try to get enough games, home games, so you have a chance of winning, because the home team wins most of the time.
You're listening to Real Sports Guys on realsportsguys.com. We've got head coach of Florida Atlantic, Mike Jarvis, on the line. Now, Coach.
Yes.
Devon and I are both from Michigan. The Fab Five, that was one of my favorite teams of all time. You know, we got a couple more minutes with you.
Okay.
I've got to ask you, what are your memories from that Sweet 16 game that you spoke of earlier in Seattle?
Well, I'll tell you, first of all, I mean, the fact that we weren't supposed to be there, we had the most incredible ride that you could imagine. We end up out there, and like I said, it's 41,000. It's the national game of the day. CBS is saying, oh, this is going to be a massacre. What are we doing this game for? Billy Packer and those guys are, you know, scratching their head. What do we do when Michigan's up by 20, you know? You know, because in those days, I mean, when they were locked into a game, there weren't a lot of options. So what happens is the game starts out, and sure enough, those guys were right in the first half. We're down 17, Michigan's rolling. And, you know, we called timeout and said, you know what, let's press these guys. I mean, it shouldn't work, but let's press them. And sure enough, we pressed them, and they, you know, Jalen Rose and those guys started throwing the ball all over the place. And we made a mistake. See, we took the lead in the game with about 3-4 minutes to go, and they actually ended up beating us.
by getting their missed shots on free throws and putting the ball back in. I think they did that like three times. If we box out and we get rebounds off of their missed free throws, we upset them. And, I mean, we're moving on to the Elite Eight. So the fact that we weren't supposed to be there and then we put ourselves in a position to actually win the game, I mean, we scared the living you-know-what out of those guys. And they whatever respect they didn't have for us, they had for us by the end of the game. And it put GW on the map, because when I first went to Washington, D.C., I remember going down Constitution Ave and stopping at one of the vendors and saying, hey, where's the GW gear? And the guy laughed at me and said, GW what? We don't have any GW gear. We got Georgetown gear. And by the time we left Washington, D.C., when I went to St. John's, they were selling a lot of GW gear, and GW was on the map. And so that was the game that put us on the map.
You're on with the Real Sports Guys. We're on with Mike Jarvis, coach at Florida Atlantic. Coach, before we close out, one of the things that we've been doing a lot is talking about the state of college sports. And
okay,
we would be remiss to have you on the show and not hit into some of the things that you spoke about earlier. We have talked a lot about all of us value education. We all have, at least two of us have worked in higher education. I continue to do so and been invested in with student-athletes. What are some of the things that you need to see that need to change to increase the academic engagement of our college athletes in terms of academic side of the institution? What things as a coach, if you were part of a Blue Ribbon committee, would allow for you to have a better balance with your athletes to get them more engaged in the academic life of the institution?
Well, I think, you know, a big part of going to college is building a resume. A big part of going to college is preparing for life after basketball. And I think that more, you know, community involvement, more somehow incorporating the life of the student into the community where they can be actually, you know, giving back and at the same time moving forward, somehow, you know, taking the things that they're learning in the classroom and share them within the community and get credit for doing that, I think would serve everybody well. And, you know, I see, my whole thing is that, you know, it's one thing to get a degree, it's another thing to get an education. And I think a lot of schools today award degrees. I think a lot of people are concerned about our kids graduating much more than they're concerned about our kids really being educated. And are they learning something that they can then use to get a job? Because in the end, it's all about a J-O-B. So I just wish that, you know, that the student athletes, they spend most of their time majoring in eligibility, taking, you know, whatever courses they're taking so that they can be eligible, as opposed to really, really being prepared and you know, for the marketplace and the job place after college. So I just, you know, I just wish that there were maybe even more potential majors, the realistic majors for kids to take, you know, while they're in college, that would actually lead to real jobs when they get out of college, and you know, and take some of that work experience, maybe summer internships, and somehow find a way to build that into the school curriculum. So, you know, so these kids will have an even better chance when they graduate of getting a real job.
That's Coach Jarvis, Mike Jarvis, the reason why we had him on the show. Coach, we definitely appreciate having you on the show. We would love to invite you back to not only talk about the Owls, but to also talk about some of these other issues that we are engaging in around college sports. And we look forward to having another conversation with you soon.
Well, thank you. I've really enjoyed it. And you guys, you know, by probing and getting into, you know, things other than what you would see on, let's say, on SportsCenter, I think is really vital. And I compliment you guys and commend you, you know, for doing what
the John Thompsons of the world years ago used to do at the conventions and get guys to really think out of the box. So thanks for having me on. I look forward to being on with you guys again. Maybe, you know, it'd be nice also to be on when I'm taking a team to the NCAA tournament, which I think is going to happen within the next year or two at FAU.
We know that, Coach, and good luck, and we look forward to having you on again. Take care.
Well, thank you.
That was Mike Jarvis, head coach, Florida Atlantic University, the Owls. Incredible person. You understand what we're trying to do with the show. These are the type of folks that we're trying to have on the show. And I'm gonna bring my guy, the Game Changer, back on. Game Changer, I know you were over there with the notes. You had the book out. I know you were reflecting. What were your thoughts about?
Wow. Excellent interview. Again, thank you to Mike, to Coach Mike Jarvis of Florida Atlantic University. You know, he compared us to John Thompson, man. I'm bugging. You know how I get down, man. That's one of my heroes. And to be compared with Big John, man, is crazy. But some things that Coach Jarvis talked about, his reflection on the whole transfer, how to handle transfers and how to negotiate the transfer process. You know, I don't fully agree with his perspective, but I understand where he's coming from as a coach. You know, we'll talk about this more when we get into the Bo Ryan, Wisconsin situation. But as a coach, you do want to try and understand why a kid is leaving your program because of the investment that you put into a kid when you recruit him. And I completely understand that there are a lot of resources that go into recruiting one player. And then when that player leaves, you really want to try, before you let that investment walk away, you really want an opportunity to hear them out and have them hear you out. And I think, you know, that can be a tough dance for a coach to do when you have a kid who really just wants to leave. And, you know, you quoted all the time, Dean Smith said that, you know, he knew it was time for him to find a different line of work when he looked around and realized that his livelihood depended upon the decisions of 18 and 19-year-olds. That's what you have with a lot of transfer situations, is guys who are young men, young athletes, looking to meet a set of priorities that may not necessarily fall in line with the priorities of the coach. The player's got a different agenda. The coach has a different agenda. And that player wants to fulfill his dream, whatever that may be. And sometimes that doesn't jive with what the coach wants, and that's where you have these mismatches of need and what's provided by the program.
Part of where I'm mixed on this or kind of struggling is, because there's two things. One aspect of the question is the free market society. So that's one part of it. And then there's an educational value conversation. And it's not unlike even when students who are not student athletes look to transfer, who might be a part of programs or part of where they have exit interviews or talking to advisors who want to know why they're transferred to a new institution. Is it a goodness of fit? So I think part of what I try to wrap my head around this is, from the educational side of it, let's have that conversation. And then there's the free market conversation. Well, in the free market conversation, everything people are probably going to debate is probably right. There's a hypocrisy. From the educational benefit side of it, and I think this is where Coach Jarvis got into it, about how these young – because nobody's talking about how these young people make decisions. Everybody's talking about their right to make a decision. And I say those are two different things, because the downfall of a 30 or 40-year-old making a decision about leaving versus an 18, 19-year-old is two different things. Repercussions of this young man, Raymond Taylor, going to the league versus doing what he might do in his school have much more repercussions than Mike Jarvis deciding to go coach at Miami. And I think that people are not talking about
I don't know about that, man.
Yes, it is. You know, you've been around college kids long enough to know that.
But
are you saying
that a coach leaving has less of an impact than
leaving? I'm talking about the impact on them personally by making a decision. I'm not talking about an impact on the program. See, again, we talked about free market in business. What I'm talking about, the impact on you.
Right, and I would say yes, on them personally. Yeah. But when you have a figurehead who ups and jumps ship from a program, I think that you're leaving not only – his life personally may not be affected, but he just affected the lives of 15 athletes who were committed to him who now have to figure out whether or not they belong in that environment anymore when a coach leaves.
But I can, you could talk about a whole bunch of other settings where administrators leave as well that impact people's livelihoods. And what I'm saying is that part is always going to change. That's like staff at universities leave all the time.
As a student of that university, you don't go there because of the advising. I tell my athletes this all the time, man. You only get to pick your coach once in your whole life. You only get to pick your coach one time, and that's when you get recruited to go to college. When that person leaves, that is a big part of your life that is going to be then controlled by someone you didn't approve.
I'm going to tell you right now, and we don't quote a lot of shows, but as Golic said, and Golic had two sons who decided to go, his advice is pick the school, not the coach. You got
no,
to
I'm not saying, I agree with that. But what I'm saying is that what you do, the coach is 1A. School is 1. Coach is 1A. And when that coach changes, again, this is a person that has a tremendous amount of control and influence over your life.
I understand that. It
has a tremendous effect.
I understand that. My cousin was supposed to play for Calipari. Calipari recruited him. And he left, and then he was left with another coach who did not have the caliber of Calipari.
You're talking about social emotional development. You're talking about a lot of things where kids can get depressed, all these kind of other things. If that part of your life isn't going well for a lot of these kids, it can have some tremendous effect.
But that is the part of it that we got to figure out how to address. That is the part of it that if you at Yale and your coach, if you go to play with Tommy Amaker at Harvard and Amaker leave, if your butt leave Harvard, you are stupid.
No, you would not leave Harvard. But if you at Central Michigan, it's only one Harvard. But if you at Central Michigan and the coach at Central Michigan leaves for another job, you stuck in Central Michigan.
But we just, hey, hold up. This is not even a scholarship. This is a scholarship program. But we just had University of Whitewater coach on. Whitewater got one of the top business schools regionally in the Midwest. Now,
Devon, but again, we're talking about scholarship athletes, man. What I'm talking about is
getting beyond that with athletes.
Listen, we're talking about practice.
Not a game.
We're talking about practice. Listen, Not a game. We're talking about practice.
This has been a good discussion, but, you know, hey, we got a special guest tonight. I'm excited. I've been waiting for this one for weeks. You know, it's always good, you know, because a couple of us, we're from Michigan, so it's always good to have one of our own on the show. And especially when they've had an illustrious career all the way through high school, through college. You know, our guest tonight was a prep star at Lloyd Norris High School in Kalamazoo, Michigan, where he was Parade Magazine and a rival National Player of the Year as a senior. Went on to Michigan State to have an amazing career where he was on second team All Big Ten, but is known, and he kind of broke my heart, was known for the touchdown to catch against Michigan in 2001 out of nowhere. Caught it in the end zone to lead the Spartans over Michigan that year. Went on first round draft choice with the Atlanta Falcons, where he was part of the run DVD, went on to play for the Lions, played for Washington and for Seattle. But what I think was great about him, what we'll have a chance to talk about, is that his life beyond sports, where he started the New World Flood, a nonprofit organization that goes into schools and teaches kids all over the country, and overseas, about really flooding the community with community service, kind acts, making a difference in the world. Please welcome to Real Sports Guys, Todd. TJ Zucchi. Welcome, TJ.
Yo, what up?
K-Zoo
in the house, what up?
We got, I'm flooded by the K-Zoo in the house.
K-Zoo in the house.
That's right.
What? It don't change.
It don't change. Ty, before we get into the interview, you heard us talking about the NFL Bali.
Yeah.
Obviously, you've played in the NFL, you're familiar, you played football, you played on both sides of the ball. Provide us with your perspective on this issue.
You know, and I caught the last tell bit of what you guys were talking about, but I do agree with what you said. When it comes to a person's livelihood, when it comes to physically hurt somebody intentionally, I can't agree with that, but interception, big play, something like that. It's an incentive amongst teams. Like you said, you got stickers in high school in junior high in the playground. You got the girls' attention. I mean, you got to make plays. And football, football is a brutal sport. It's a barbarian sport. I mean, when I ran the ball, my job, I wanted to punish you. And if that meant, you know, you're getting a headache, something happening to you, you're getting hurt, that's part of what my job, my running style was. Now, I wouldn't want anything to happen after the 60 minutes and on the street, but within the lines, you know, you got to go out and be that warrior. So it's hard to separate the two, but if you're going to intentionally hurt somebody, I can't agree with that.
Now, you played on some good teams. Did you have that folks who on the defense or whatever that had those kind of competitive things they put with each other? Was that things that on offer you knew folks talking about?
I mean, yeah, even like as kids. I mean, who's the first person to go down on a kickoff? Who's the first person to touch the ball carrier? It was back then it might have been you get a donut, you know what I'm saying? But as a kid, you get instilled with that's part of the game is to go and we highlight the most physical, the most dangerous, the most meanest competitor. We highlight that. So
that's
now
right.
That it's brought to light, it's like, oh, how could they? But you glorify the big hits and you glorify all this and you want to see that. So, I mean, if I don't recommend that I'm not with intentionally going to hurt somebody, but it's like saying tell Michael Jordan you can't dunk all game because you're too good. You know, I mean that's just he'll go and he'll dunk every play if possible, but you can't do that. So that's how I look at it.
So Todd, this is Phil here. You know, obviously, you had an excellent collegiate career as well as a professional career in the NFL. One of the reasons, you know, I really wanted to target you to get you on the show is because you have done an excellent job transitioning to your next career after the NFL. You know, recently you were a keynote speaker at the Personal Branding for Athletes, transitioning from the NFL to your next career, which was at LSU's Business School, which is quite an honor for them to pick all the athletes and to pick a young man like yourself that has done so much in the little time that you've been away from the NFL. Can you talk about that experience as well as your transition to your current career?
Yeah. Technically, I wasn't a keynote speaker for that event, but I did it the first year. And when I went into it, before that, let me back it up. Before that, when I stopped playing, I went through a depression, and I didn't really have any identity of who I was, what I was about. I didn't know much about me as a person because I got caught up in me as an athlete, which is part of why I go by Todd now as a person. So I went through that whole ups, downs, had interesting time for those couple months. And then I got presented with an opportunity to go to LSU for the NFL Personal Branding seminar. And I went and I realized there's a lot of guys in my same situation. And I started a my brother Tico started a janitorial supplies company, and I jumped into that with him. I invested with him about, say, 4 or 5 years before all this. And so my thought is, you know, get them playing, jump in there, and I'd go. But even then, I still didn't feel like I had an identity. So going to this branding seminar, it really gave me a lot of confidence. It gave me a new focus on the personal side of me and how I can translate from athlete to businessman and do it in a successful manner. And after a year of that, I had a chance to start some businesses, start some nonprofits, had a chance to get going, and the confidence and the success came from that seminar. So this past July, they had the same exact group and invited me back again to share just my experience. It's a different lifestyle when you go from being one place one minute over a phone call, instantly everything changes, and everything that everyone has viewed you as is no longer the case, and you still have to live and be and try to exist without that being the focal point of your life. And I just felt like, and I believed I had so much more, and that seminar really brought it out. And even some of the guys that I talked to today who went there and who are now being successful, it is a period where you have to get acclimated to a different type of life. And a lot of my volunteering and a lot of my helping really brought so many things back home to me compared to what I was living in the way the people I was hanging around and what was fact and what was reality to the people where I'm from. And that changed my life as well. So after leaving football and after the Brandon seminar and really getting courage and knowing some strength of who I was, then I was really able to get involved with people and have a genuine heart that really wanted to help and help change lives. And that's where I'm at today.
I mean, that's a perfect transition. I mean, your story, which brings us to your work today. You recently developed an organization by the name of A New World Flood, and
yep.
You know, just going throughout the website, the slogan says a single raindrop is the beginning of a flood.
Yep.
Can you talk about that statement as well as what this organization is working on right now?
Yes, New World Flood, newworldflood.org. You can check it out while I talk. It's about every person, whether it's a kid, whether it's a adult, every single person matters. Every single person has self-worth, self-value. So with every single person being a raindrop, every raindrop from the sky, when it comes down, it has a purpose. It starts off billions of miles in the sky, and then it comes and lands right on your shoulder. It has a purpose to come to you. Now, as a child, an adult, being born, there's billions of different things going on, and these are two people, your parents, and you get born, you have a purpose. But in order to fulfill your purpose, you have to know how valuable you are, and you have to know your self-worth, and you have to know what education and wisdom is, and all these things do, so you don't make dumb decisions. You don't put yourself, your body, your mind in compromising situations. You value yourself at a high piece. And if each person has that one thought, if each person has that value, that self-esteem, and one person goes and picks up trash, and another one says they matter and they go and help somebody else, now you got different people throughout the community who have their values who say, no, I'm not going to do that, or yes, I'm going to come help. You have people doing that all over, then you have a flood of giving and service throughout your whole entire community, and things will happen, and a new world will be created of giving and service. So that's the whole philosophy behind that newworldflood.org.
Now, Todd, this is Devon. You were just in Africa recently, weren't you? Can you talk a little about that experience?
Yeah, this is my second trip there, and about 8 months ago, I was blessed to co-found the school, but I was blessed to get involved with a school there. And within the last 2 years, we've been able to help the school really grow. The age group is from 2 to 7, and then once you turn 7, you enter the it's in Arusha, Tanzania, so you enter the Tanzanian standardized test. And if you can't pass that test, then you really have some issues to how you're really going to continue your education. So we have a school that prepares kids for this test. And being there this past, actually last month, I was there, and we started a new part of the school called the Flood Gardens, where we're tearing down, not literally tearing down the walls, but we're expanding the classroom outside the four walls, and we're teaching kids about farming. We're teaching them how to raise animals. We're teaching them how to educate with stuff that they have, with materials that they have around them. But at the same time, the garden's producing vegetables and food for the people in the village to eat, and they're also being able to take what they grow into the community to sell. So we've been able to take a school and continue their education and grow the numbers, and we've been able to impact the community with food and with empowering them to possibly sustain a living. But the overall goal is we gave them a chance to believe in life and what is out there for them, and that people care, and that they have a chance to succeed, and they're not just forgotten people. And a big mission that I have and that we're doing is we're getting ready to buy 10 acres of land there now and help them create their community with our assistance. We're not coming in and running the show for them. We're giving them the tools so their culture can grow, and them as their people, they can grow it with all that they want. But we are helping them and we're assisting them just with some of the structure. And with this so far, we've had an amazing turnout with people who are wanting to help, with the young men who are there taking more of ownership in what they can be. I'm talking 13, 14-year-old young men who are believing that they will get out of a slum or have a chance to actually get a job. And it's big and powerful to do that when you see young women here who are fighting for the same thing. But to be able to have that impact on the other side of the world in a culture that is deep-rooted in all of us, to be able to have impact in those people and our people, it moves me like no other. So that's what I got going on over there.
Todd, I mean, I think, you know, I'm so glad that at least on Real Sports Guys, we're able to provide you with this space to talk about these things. Because I think in the world of sports, we often don't have a chance to see the great impact a lot of our great leaders I've had in the kind of the legacy of Lou Alcindor and all the other folks who had that greater kind of view of their impact in the world, now Kareem. We definitely want to thank you for being on the Real Sports Guys tonight, and we definitely appreciate having you here.
I appreciate y'all having me. It's a great show y'all do, and keep it up, man. Keep it up. Let me know if I can ever be of an assistance or anything, but it's beautiful. Beautiful. I appreciate your time, and thank you for the opportunity.
And you keep doing the people's work, man. Take care.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Thank you.
All right. Todd Duckett. That's what we're talking about, y'all. Incredible. We're going to bring R.J. Page back in. And the reason why this is important, and we'll let R.J. talk a little bit. And you heard Todd refer to R.J. A lot in the connection. But, you know, RJ, I want to give you a chance to have a reaction to what you heard. It was an amazing interview, a lot there, but I want to get your initial reaction to what we talked about.
Indeed, man. That was dating for me. You know, I used to watch Todd run around my crib playing ball, playing football with my little brother. And I just got to say, man, I'm extremely impressed and proud of the man that he's become. It did me well to hear all the great things he had going on. And you mentioned Kareem while you were interviewing him. Sometimes when I'm watching sports right now, I get a little disappointed in today's athletes. I yearn for the days when we had Kareem, we had Jim Brown, we had Bill Russell. These were athletes who stood for something, who had a cause. They knew where they came from, and they supported where they came from. And to see and hear what Todd is doing in Africa, what he's doing in the Lansing community, man, major kudos. Keep doing what you're doing, brother. And, man, the sports world would be a lot better place if we had more athletes like Todd.
You're on with the Real Sports Guys, our pre-tournament show. As we prepare, we're happy to have VCU Rams associate head coach Mike Rhodes on with us. How are you doing, Coach?
All right, doing great. Watching a lot of tape, getting ready for our next game.
That's right. You got the Shockers coming up. Coach, before we get in to talking about your game with the Shockers, one of the things that's been exciting about watching your team is that this team has a different makeup than the team that made the run to the Final Four. You have, you know, one senior, Bradford Burgess, that is your leading scorer, but you have a different makeup to this team. Can you talk a little bit about the makeup of your squad that's getting ready for the tournament?
Sure, you bet. Absolutely. I mean, we have a lot of new faces. We have a lot of guys that have bigger roles and new roles. And, you know, Bradford Burgess, who had a great run through the NCAA tournament last year as a junior, is really our only guy back with major, major minutes and, you know, and a huge role in the past. And, you know, of course, we have guys that have stepped up. Darius Theus, who played a great game in the championship game against Drexel. He's been a catalyst for as this year went on. And then Troy Daniels and Rob Vandenberg, two young guys that have roles have stepped up. And then we've got great production from some really young guys, Briante Weber and Travian Graham, and of course, Javonte Redick and DJ Haley. Those guys have really stepped up. And I don't think anyone thought we'd be in this position. But what I think we did was we just kept getting better every week, every month, and we put ourselves in a position at the end of the year to try to win our league, and we did that.
We've got Western Carolina head coach Larry Hunter in the Real Sports Guys studio. How you doing today, Coach?
I'm doing good, Phil. Thank you.
Coach, you and your teams officially started off March Madness a couple of days ago. you and Davidson squared off in the Southern Conference Final to the tune of a double overtime game. Your team fought back after being down 13 points with just under 3 minutes left in the game. Coach, walk me through the last couple of minutes of regulation as well as the overtimes in terms of how you were instructing your troops.
Well, you know, it had been a pretty well-played game from both teams' perspective. Just a good basketball game, really competitive, and you know, guys just going at each other. So that kind of set the tempo. And, of course, you were playing for that NCAA berth in the conference championship. And, you know, the game was getting away from us a little bit. They had executed pretty well. And, you know, basketball is a game of momentum, and they had hit kind of a momentum streak and opened up a 10, 11-point lead there, maybe even a 13-point lead. It's hard to keep it all straight now. But I remember at the timeout, you know, we talked about, I looked at our guys, and some guys were starting to cramp up. We were, you know, we were really fatigued. You could see it. And I just told them, I said, I know you're tired, but you're playing for an awful lot. You've worked so hard to get here. Dig down deep and find whatever energy you got and compete your doggone heads off. And, you know, stranger things have happened. Make some plays and hit some shots, and let's see what happens. And that's kind of what we went about doing. I think we got to the foul line. We got a couple steals. Trey Summer, our point guard, hit two big threes. He actually banked one of them in. But that's just kind of the mindset we were in. And then, you know, got it right down to the final few seconds, and Keaton Cole, our real good shooter, got fouled on a three-point attempt, and he made all three threes, all three free throws to send it to the first overtime. So, you know, that gave us a little shot in the arm. We get to the overtimes, and I've never seen, you know, Trey Sumler to me is the ultimate warrior. We've known this, you know, the 2 years that he's been here. He's just so competitive, and he's just such a tough kid. But he had cramps in his calves and in his thighs. My assistant coaches were rubbing the knots. You know, you've had cramps before. You know how your muscles just knot right up. And he would kind of limp out of the huddle, and he was not drawing attention to himself in the timeout. You know, he wasn't like he was pointing to the trainers. You know, he was just sitting there. He was focused on what we were talking about, and you know, he didn't say anything. He just got right back up, went out there, and I remember, you know, he limps back out on the floor, and then the young man he was guarding goes over a ball screen with the dribble.
Yes.
Somehow he fights up over that and moves his feet and gets in front of him. I thought, oh my gracious, I can't believe it. But just really, really proud of our guys. You know, we got it. We made some plays. I thought we had it won at the end of the first overtime. Haruna Mutombo got a steal. And he flipped it back. He saved it out of bounds and flipped it back into Keaton Cole right at the basket. And one of their players made a great block, or that was going to be the ball game because it was tied at that point. And then it went into the second overtime. And, you know, I think the crowd and the people who were watching the game just fed off of how hard we were competing and how we just would not give in, and the determination, the will to win that we had. And I told him in our last timeout there, it was 13 seconds. I called timeout with 13 seconds to go. And we were down two. I said, guys, we're not going to go for the tie. We're going to go for the win. And then, you know, how you do as a coach, you try to set the stage, you know, said that, you know, we're gonna execute this play. We're gonna get Keaton Cole a wide open jumper, and we're gonna be celebrating here in a few minutes. So we did everything but celebrate. Keaton got a great look at it, and he's hit those shots for us all season long. And this one just didn't go down, but we gave it a great effort.
But in the meantime, I'd like to welcome our next guest, Coach Tamika Randall. Former Tennessee Vol player, a member of the Meat era Lady Vol teams, current coach at Ohio University. Coach Randall, how are you doing tonight?
I'm doing pretty good. And yourself?
I'm doing great. Again, I'd like to thank you for joining us tonight. You're on with the Real Sports Guys. Listeners out there, hit us up at realsportsguys.com. Coach, can you give us kind of a brief overview of how your season went this year?
Well, one thing I want to say, taking a job was in a rebuilding process. So entering in the fourth year, my fourth year here, or finishing it up, I should say, I saw a lot of progress within our team. Obviously, it wasn't on the win column. I felt like we left maybe four or five games out there on the floor. So we overall ended up with a 14-18 record, and we ended up advancing to the second round of our tournament for the second straight year in a row. We had some keynote wins against Bowling Green, which is our big rival, and I believe if memory serves me, is maybe they say over a decade we beat them at home. So that was pretty, you know, unique and cool for our kids. And then going out to Vegas to play in a tournament, we ended up beating Xavier, who has had in the past a phenomenal career in terms of making it to the NCAA tournament. So we had some peaks, some really high moments, and I think the best is yet to come for our basketball team. And that's just, you know, talking about a few things that I felt we did as a program.
Now, when you're talking about the program that you're building, what kind of style of play can fans and people expect to see with your team?
Well, what they started to see in the past couple of years is the fact that we are a team that likes to press and get after it to speed the tempo up. Just games, you see the teams that are fun are the ones that like to push the ball up the floor and try to create easy opportunities. I try to paint a picture with our kids and say, we want to shoot as many layups as we possibly can. So that means we got to really emphasize about on makes and miss, really getting that ball out and players running their lanes hard. So that's the style, and that's less thinking for kids. So they kind of really buy into that. But for the most part, we had to start it on the defensive end, and you know, obviously I was a defensive player at Tennessee, so we've done some pretty amazing things, and really all 4 years of me being here with that of holding teams to below their shooting average to basically rebounding, doing all those fun things, contesting on the three-point line, making people shoot a low percentage. So we've been able to do some really good things off of that and create off of, that creates offense for us.
Now, Coach, you're selling yourself short a little bit. You say you're a defensive player, all right? You're selling yourself short a little bit. Anybody with the nickname Hard to Handle Randall was a heck of a defensive player. What do you look for in recruits, given that that's your orientation to the game and that's the approach you take and that's your philosophy, that's the basis of how you build your teams? What kind of kids are you looking for as a coach? Who are you looking for as a recruit?
Well, I think when you're building, you're always looking for toughness. I think every coach in America is trying to find that tough kid that's resilient, that can push through things. I guess I might have this ego. I feel like I could teach anybody how to play defense if they're willing to do it. It's just understanding the system and being able to follow it and commit to it, because our defense is about a team defense. It's not just individually one player just being an exceptional defender. We want to do it in a team thing where we have our rotations, and you know, it's important that we box out. So we spend a lot of time on emphasizing those things to create toughness within our team.
Coach Randall, you were a part of a Final Four run yourself. Can you let our listeners? Yeah, absolutely.
Quite a few
with the Lady Vols. You guys were running the show back in your day in the late 90s out there at the University of Tennessee. Can you share with the listeners what it's like to prepare yourself as a player, and then give us the perspective of what you know, how your coaches went about their business and things that you learned from watching your coaching staff?
Well, I have to just kind of key you in on just the 98 team and that just being a special, unique team, and you don't get an opportunity to see that often, and you're probably witnessing right now with Baylor, and it's been with UConn. There's been very few teams that have been able to do that undefeated type thing. So with that particular team in mind, we had such an air of confidence and composure and toughness, everything that coaches look for in players. We felt like every time we stepped on that court, we were going to win a basketball game. And one of the unique things and beautiful things about it, it wasn't about winning by 1 point. It was trying to annihilate people and do whatever we could. It wasn't really trying to run a score up, but if that's what it meant, we were gonna do that. So everyone had that connect. Tamika, to Shamiqua, to Kelly Jolly, myself, and the rest of our teammates. We literally, it was like a dogfight. You put me in there for 5 seconds, I'm gonna give you everything I got. If you leave me in there for 30 minutes, I'm gonna let you know that, you know, the Lady Vols are in the house and we're ready to play and compete on both ends of the floor. It wasn't just about being a specialty player and say, hey, all I can do is shoot threes. No, you were gonna be able to defend, you were gonna be able to rebound, you were gonna box somebody out, you were gonna set the best screen. You just had that mentality. And now I will say, as the years went along, my junior year, it was about experience because we've been there before. And when you be a part of tradition, you kind of know how to hold yourself. You don't get wild by the whole experience of walking into the gym and being overwhelmed by the blue carpet where all the media rows are set out. You just know you're supposed to be there and you're supposed to get it done. So it's just a different approach when you're a part of tradition where, like, you, if you're a 16 seed or 15 seed, you're just happy to be there. Tennessee expected to be there.
Ray, Devon, Marcus, the Game Changer, myself, Phil T, will be back with you May 22nd.